Okay. So first of all, I would like to thank the organizer for giving me the opportunity to give a talk in this workshop. And I will begin saying that this is a joint work with Marius Jung from the University of Illinois at Urbana, David Pérez and Ignacio Villanueva from the Universidad Complutense de Madrid, and Michael Wolf from the Niels Institute. And well, about the talk, the title is Operator Spaces, a Natural Language for Berlin Inequalities, and my idea is to present how functional analysis, and in particular the operator space theory, appears in the context of Berlin inequalities, and at the same time to introduce some new results which have been obtained by using these techniques. Okay? But if the goal of quantum information science is to study the advantages of computing or process the information by using quantum mechanics instead of classical theory, Bell inequalities are one of the most useful tools to do this. And actually, these inequalities allow us to quantify these advantages. Okay? So in this sense, the first part of the talk will consist on a short motivation of the problem we are going to study. After that, I will comment the very well-known case of correlations Bell inequalities in the bipartite case. And in the last two points, I will comment the new results. So in the third point, I will study the tripartite case, I mean the correlation Bell inequalities in the tripartite case, and in the last point, which actually is under construction, I will introduce some new results in the general problem where we have again two parties, and now we look at the general probability distribution instead of just at the correlations, okay? So then let me introduce the problem. So suppose we have a physical system which is formed by two physical subsystems. We can think, for instance, in a two-particle system. And there are two people, say Alice and Bob, and Alice is going to measure over the first particle and Bob over the second one. Okay, so if we focus on the moment for the Alice part, Alice can carry out some different measurements, which I'm going to denote with the letter X, and each of these measurements has some possible outputs, that is, some possible results. Okay, and we'll denote these results with the letter A, and the same for Bob with the letters Y and B. Okay, so if we suppose we can repeat this experiment, these measurements, as many times as we want, we could get a good approximation, a good experimental approximation of the probability PABXY, which is the probability of obtaining the pair AB when Alice and Bob measure respectively with the inputs X and Y. Okay? And not that I have not mentioned any physical theory until here. Actually, depending on the physical theory we assume to explain nature, we will write this number in one way or in another one. Okay? So, suppose, on the one hand, we consider the set of these vectors, that is, the set of these elements, okay, which can be explained if we assume that nature is local and deterministic, local and classical. Okay, I will explain this later. Okay, and one of the elements of this set will be called classical behaviors. Okay, and on the other hand, we can consider the set of these elements which can be explained if we assume quantum mechanics to explain nature. Okay, and each of the elements of these new sets will be called quantum behavior. Okay? So it is very easy to see that every classical behavior is in particular a quantum behavior, but the converse is not so clear. Okay? Nowadays, it is well known that this is not clear, that this is the starting point of the problem. Okay? So if we want to separate these both sets, there is a natural way to do it. Okay? So suppose we take some real coefficient, that is, some real vector, and we take, on the other hand, the supremum of this vector acting on the set of all classical behaviors, okay? When the action is the natural one, I mean, the standard scalar problem, okay? So we take the supremum of T over all classical behavior with the absolute value, and on the other hand, we take the supremum of T over all quantum behavior in the absolute value. As I have said, every classical behavior is in particular a quantum behavior, so it's trivial that this quotient is larger or equal one, but if we find some coefficient for which this quotient is strictly larger than one, we have done. I mean, the sets are different, okay? So in order to normalize this quotient, I'm going to call Bell inequality to some real coefficient such that the supremum of T over all classical behavior is equal to one, okay? And for a given Bell inequality, I will call the largest violation of this Bell inequality as this quotient, which will be just the supremum of T over all quantum behaviors, okay? And actually, this gives us a natural notion of distance between the set of classical behaviors and the set of quantum behaviors. Okay, just take the supremum of the largest violation over all Bell inequalities. Okay? So, as I said, I'm going to try to explain why this problem is important and why this notion of distance is important and natural. Okay? And I will do it in the physical framework, and we will discuss the mathematical point of view later. Okay? So, I choose 3 points to comment. The first one is the quantum formalism. So this is the most theoretical one, but if regarding quantum formalism, it could be really interesting to have a complete understanding about the geometry of the problem. That is, we would like to be able to compute distance or to compute volumes of certain sets, or we would like to be able to characterize the set of classical behavior or the set of quantum behaviors, okay? So, of course, this would imply many applications, many physical applications, but rather than this, it could imply an increase of our understanding of quantum mechanics. So maybe one day we have to change or to adapt this theory because of some new experimental result, and the more information we have about this theory, the easier it will be, no? So from the purely theoretical point of view, the problem is interesting, but more specifically, the key point in quantum information theory is the quantum entanglement. Okay, this is a concept for which we can do some manipulations that we cannot do in the classical framework. Okay, and it can be seen that the only way to detect entanglement, to detect experimental entanglement, if we do not assume any hypothesis of our system, is by computing violations of the inequality. And with this, I mean that if we have some behavior in the previous sense, such that this behavior does not violate any Bell inequality, it is known that we can write this behavior by using a non-entangled state, that is, a non-entangled state shaped by Alice and Bob. Okay? So in this sense, the problem we are studying is completely connected to the most important concept of quantum information theory. And actually, this says that the distance we are computing, that is the distance based on the largest violations of Bell inequality, seems to be a good tool to detect quantum resources. Okay? Well, maybe the most appealing point is the third one, that is the applications. No? So in some sense, the problem we are dealing with is the study of the problem, do we really have advantages if we use quantum mechanics instead of classical theory, and actually how can we measure or how can we quantify these advantages? No? So the idea is that if we have a Bell inequality which gives some violations, then we can propose a problem in a general way, okay, such that if we allow to use quantum resources to solve this problem, that is, if we allow to use some kind of protocol which uses quantum resources, then the success probability of this protocol is strictly larger than the success probability of any other classical protocol, that is, any other protocol which only uses classical resources, okay? And actually, the quotient between the quantum success probability divided by the classical success probability is proportional to the largest violation of the Bell inequality we are using to propose this problem, okay? So, I mean, I'm talking in a very, very general way, but it's very difficult to explain all the applications in a couple of statements, so it's just to have an idea of what kind of application and what kind of, how can we quantify these advantages, okay? So, of course, there will be many other applications, and I'm sure that most of you will know these possible applications much better than me, but I wanted to comment some of them, okay? So, the final idea is that the problem we are studying is very important because it's connected to the most important concepts of quantum information theory, and the results we obtain in this context or in this problem have many applications to other areas of quantum information and quantum computation. And actually, the notion of distance we are measuring seems to be a good tool to detect quantum resources. Okay, so when this has been said, the rest of the talk will be mainly mathematics. Okay. So the problem we want to solve, that is to characterize or to measure distance between the set of classical behaviors and the set of quantum behaviors, is difficult. So we will start by doing some simplifications. Okay, so suppose in the previous measurements, each of the Alice measurements and Bob measurements has only two possible outputs, plus one and minus one. Okay, and we are going to focus on the multiplication of the outputs. Okay, so we are going to focus on, Alice measures, Bob measures, and the multiplier outputs. Okay, and as before, if we repeat many times this experiment, we could get a good approximation of the average of these values, okay? Be careful because I'm changing the notation. I'm denoting each of the Alice measurements by I, while I did it before with X, I think, but it's just because it's the common notation in the correlation case, okay? So, if we assume that a local hidden variable model to describe nature, nature is classical and is local, then we will write this number in the following way, okay? So, in this case, we assume that there is a hidden probability over the possible states of the world, such that for each of these states, natively deterministic, and it's local. So for each of these states, we will have a deterministic value for the Alice measurements, that is plus one and minus one, and the same for Bob. Okay? And to compute the average, we will have to compute the average over all the states of the world. Okay? So this is what is written here. And on the other hand, if we assume quantum mechanics to describe nature, we will have to write this number in the following way, when now we will need a density operator which describes the bipartite case, that is a density operator which adds a tensor product of two Hilbert space, and each of Alice measurements will be described as a self-adjoint operator with any values plus one and minus one and the same for both. Okay? So, as before, we would like to separate these both sets. I mean, the set of classical correlation matrices and the set of quantum correlation matrices. Okay? But, this problem has been studied in depth, so I'm going to change a little bit the point of view, and I'm going to focus on the connections to classical function analysis. Okay, so I'm going to use three classical tensor norms, which I'm not going to define, but the P norm is the biggest tensor norm we can define on a tensor product of two Banach spaces. The epsilon norm is the smallest one, and the omega norm is a very important tensor norm in classical Banach spaces. Actually, it is in some sense the most important tensor norm in Grothendieck's work about the metric theory of tensor product. Okay, so I'm not going to do any computation with this norm, so I think it's better not to define it. Okay, but suppose we have a real matrix, okay, and consider the associated tensor product in the following way. When I'm denoting L infinity sub n, the real and linear space with the supremum norm. Okay, this is a standard. Okay, so we can see this vector in this way, and E sub I is the canonical basis. Okay, so it can be proved the following. Gamma is a classical correlation matrix if and only if U is in the closed unit ball of L infinity projective L infinity. Gamma is a quantum correlation matrix if and only if U belongs to the closed unit ball of this tensor product with the omega tensor norm. Okay. And actually, it can be seen that gamma is a non-singularly correlation matrix if and only if U is in the closed unit ball of this space. I have not defined it what a non-singularly property is, so just forget it. The people who don't know which is, just forget it the last equivalence. But what I want to show is that three classical norms in functional analysis exactly describe the three physical sets we are interested in. So in this sense, it's not just that functional analysis is a good tool to study this problem. I mean, in some sense, it is the natural tool to study this, okay? So, well, I'm a mathematician, eh? So, well, then as before, we are going to take some real coefficients, okay? And we are going to separate this both set, classical correlations matrices and the quantum correlations matrices, take it the supremum of this real coefficient over all these elements, okay? But now we take a real coefficient, oh, some real coefficients, and we take the supremum of this over all classical correlation matrices, but I've said that this is the same that take the supremum of this coefficient over all the elements of the closed unit ball of some space, so it's exactly the same to compute the norm as the dual, I mean, as an element in the dual of this space, okay? So for us, the Bell inequality is nothing else as some real coefficient such that as a bilinear form on L infinity has norm small a equal 1, okay? And in the same way, the largest violation of this Bell inequality is exactly the norm of this element as an element of the dual of this space. Okay, so of course what we have to do is use Grothendieck's inequality, because Grothendieck's inequality exactly says that the P norm and the omega norm are equivalent on L infinity tensor L infinity. Okay, so using this, I mean, Sigerson didn't talk about all these tensor norms, but using this, Sigerson proved that the largest violation of the correlation Bell inequality is uniformly bounded by Kg, by the Grothendieck constant. Okay, and I've written uniformly to denote that this constant does not depend on the number, I mean, on the dimension of the L infinity, or which is the same of the dimension of the number of measurements in each path, okay? And it does not depend of the dimension of the Hilbert space we are using to construct the quantum correlation matrix, okay? Well, I have said that the notion of distance we are considering is natural in the physical framework, and I've said now that actually, it's the natural one also in the mathematical framework, because we are actually computing the Banach Mathur distance between two Banach spaces. And in the Banach space category, the natural distance is the Banach, the Banach Mathur one. Okay, so mathematically, this is also, everything is natural. Okay? Well, so this uniform bound involves limitations. Okay, I'm saying that the largest violation is connected to the advantages we have if we use quantum mechanics instead of classical theory. But we have a uniform bound of these largest violations. So we would like to improve this result. We would like to get larger violations, okay? And there are two natural ways to try to do this, okay? First of all, we could consider more people. We could consider correlation spell inequalities, but now with Alice, Bob, and Charlie, okay? Maybe there is still a uniform bound, but maybe this bound is greater or bigger than the Grothendieck constant. And even more, Searson asked about the existence of such a constant in the trilinear case, in the tripartite case, okay? Because we didn't know if there was a uniform constant to describe, to the largest violation in the correlation case for three parties, okay? So this is the first way, and the second possibility is the general problem. So don't simplify the problem. Don't assume that each of the Alice measurement and each of the Bob measurement has only two possible outputs. And if you do it, don't look at the multiplication of the outputs, no, because you are losing too much information. Okay, so I'm going to start with the first one. So now we consider three people, Alice, Bob, and Charlie. So the problem is completely analogous to the bipartite case. So we will have to consider the classical correlation matrices, which are defined exactly in the same way, but now we have to consider the Charlie's measurements, okay? And in the quantum case, exactly the same. So we will need to tensorize with the sets of joint operators which describe the Charlie's measurements, okay? And again, we can identify a Bell inequality with some real coefficients, now with three index, okay? Such that as a trilinear form on L infinitive has norm smaller or equal one, okay? But the problem is that the omega norm does not describe, in this case, the set of quantum correlation matrices, and we must consider the operator space category, okay? So, in order to understand the result I'm going to introduce, it is necessary to know something about operator spaces, okay? So I'm going to define or to introduce a couple of concepts of this theory, but I'm going to give a very simple point of view. So, actually, I do recommend you to forget my explanation at the end of this talk, because tomorrow Professor Efros is going to introduce this theory, and he will do it, of course, and finally better than me, okay? This is just to understand these results, okay? An operator space is a complex vector space E, and a sequence of norms in the space of E-valued matrices, MN of E, which can be identified algebraically with MN tensor E, which verify two properties, okay? Two properties that I'm not going to use. So, just to say that the first property talks about the well behavior with respect to the multiplication by scalar matrices in each level. Okay. And the second one is talks about the well behavior respect to the direct sum of operator spaces. When we take the direct sum. Okay. Well, maybe this is not the best way to explain what an operator space an operator space is. Okay. So, but I wanted to point out that we are going to deal with a complex vector space and a sequence of norm on the space MN tensor E. This is all that I need, okay? But to have an idea, an operator space is nothing else than a closed subspace of B of H, of the space of operator on a Hilbert space, the operators on a Hilbert space, H, okay? Or, more exactly, it's a closed subspace joined with the sequences of norms which are inherited from this embedding, okay? This definition is equivalent to the previous one. Okay, but I'm not going to explain this. I suppose this will be done tomorrow. So, in particular, as a closed subspace of B of H, any C star algebra has a natural operator space structure. In particular, an infinitive is a commutative C star algebra. Okay, so it has a natural operator space structure. Okay? Well, maybe the best way to understand the difference between the operator space category and the Banach space category is looking at the morphisms that we have to consider to preserve the category, okay? So while in the Banach space theory, we have to consider the bounded operator, that is the linear map which has continued or which has bounded is the same. In this case, we have to consider the completely bounded map, okay? And a completely bounded map is a linear map between operator spaces such that all the dilations in the following way are bounded, okay? So we take a dilation, which is just tensorized with the identity, and now we have a norm here just because of the definition of the operator space, and we can check if it's bounded or not. Okay, and the completely bounded norm of U is defined as the supreme of this norm of the dilations. Okay, so it's in the same way as in the C-star algebra, but now we can define it on operator spaces. Okay. The problem is that we are going to consider, or we are going to deal with the a linear form. So we have to define the completely bounded norm of a linear form. Okay, but the definition is completely analogous. Okay, the completely bounded norm of a multilinear form T is the supremum of the dilations, but now each of the dilations is obtained by tensorizing n times with the identity. Okay, it's completely analogous. A multilinear map is called completely bounded if and only if the completely bounded norm of T is finite, of course. Okay, so it's completely analogous. Well, then the connections we have is the following. Given a correlation between the quantity T, which again is some real coefficients such as a prelinear form on L infinitive has norm smaller or equal 1, the largest violation of T is given at the universal constant by the completely bounded norm of T. Okay? Or which is equivalent if we take some real metrics with 3 index, okay, and we consider again the associated tensor. Now we have to consider the tensor product of 3 L infinity because we are in the tripartite case. As before, gamma is a classical correlation matrix if and only if using the closed unit ball of this space. Okay, but now gamma is a quantum correlation matrix if and only if using the closed unit ball of the L infinitive tensor L infinitive tensor L infinitive with the projective tensor norm in the sense of operator spaces. Okay, well, I have not defined this norm and I'm not going to do it, but it's just to have an analogy with the previous case. Okay, I'm going to work with the completely bounded norm, so it's equivalent by duality. Okay, but we have to realize that now we have to go to the operator space category to represent the quantum correlation matrices. So this is the natural framework to work. Okay, and the if and only if is because now it's up to constant. Eh? In the correlation bipartite case, the if and only if is exactly the same. Okay, so. Well, so now we can return to Cederson's question about the existence of a uniform bound in the tripartite case, okay, which is equivalent to see if the P norm in the classical Banach sense and the projective tensor norm in the Banach space category are equivalent, okay. But these connections allows us to use all the mathematical results developed in the operator space category, okay, and using these. It can be proved that in the tripartite case, there does not exist such a constant. In the tripartite case, we can get violations as large as we want. Okay? So specifically, we can prove, or it can be proved, that for every dimension n, there exists, first of all, another dimension n, capital letter, and a pure state rho acting on this Hilbert space. Okay? So norm ones are subjoint operators for Alice, I mean, measurements for Alice, Charlie, and Bob, and a Bell inequality. Okay, such that the action of this Bell inequality over the quantum correlation matrices formed by this state and these measurements is larger or equal to square root of n. Okay, so give me the constant you want, that if I consider a high enough dimension of the Hilbert space, I can get larger violations of two constants. Okay, and actually, the order square root of n is optimal in the dimension. This means that for every state which acts, for every state rho which acts on a Hilbert space, if one of the dimension of one of the Hilbert spaces is n, then the largest violation that this state can give on a Bell inequality is smaller or equal, less or equal square root of n. Okay. Well, so the result is very good, no? So unbounded violations, unbounded advantages of using quantum mechanics instead of classical theory. The weak point is that the proof of the theorems is highly non-constructive. It's not totally non-constructive, but it's highly non-constructive. Well, I'm not going to discuss here the possible implementations in a lab because I wouldn't know how to do it. So from the purely theoretical point of view, the result is very good, no? So we were looking for larger violations than in the bipartite case, and we have found that there exist unbounded violations, no? So is the best we could expect. Okay? Well, I have not mentioned anything about the number of measurements we need in each party. Okay? That is the dimension of the L infinity we need. Okay? So I'm going to state exactly the same theorem, but focusing on other parameters. Okay? And then we have, for every n, there exists another n capital letter and a trilinear form on this L infinity, such that the norm of T is smaller or less or equal 1, and such that the completely bounding is, the completely bounding norm of T is bigger or equal square root of n. Okay? So, to find such a violation, we need to use a very large dimension of the Hilbert space, which is the same, a very large number of measurements in each part. Okay? So what this version of the theorem says is that while the theorem is optimal in the dimension of the Hilbert space we are using to construct the quantum correlation matrix, it is not optimal in the number of measurements in each part. Okay? So, open question. To give some estimation of the norm of this application, the identity from 3L infinity to 3L infinity, when we write here the projective tensor norm in the operator space category and in the other space the P norm. Okay? Of course, as a function of n, which is what we don't know. Okay? So, somebody knows any idea, please? Well, I have said that there were two natural ways to try to get larger violation. To consider more people in the correlation case, or to consider the general case. Okay, so we have now two people measuring Alice and Bob again, but we are going to focus on the whole probability or on the whole behavior instead of just on the correlations, okay, on the multiplication of the outputs. And okay, so as before, we have to say what a classical behavior is, but it is completely analogous to the correlation case. So we assume again that there exists a hidden probability over the possible states of the world, and such that if we fix one of these states, nature is deterministic and it is local. No? So then this means that for every measurement, for every of Alice measurements, x, we have a deterministic measurement. That is, all the probabilities are either 0 or 1. Okay? And the same for both. Okay? I'm not going to explain this in detail because it's very easy. Okay? So now we can prove the following connection. P is a classical behavior if and only if the associated tensor U, in this case we have to consider more index, okay, belongs to the closed unit ball of L infinity n of L1, P L infinity L of L1. Okay? So a couple of remarks. First of all, I have remarked a lot the if and only if, because the connection in this case are not so clear. Okay? So, but in order to show the ideas we are developing, I prefer to cheat a little bit, okay, and although some of the identifications I'm going to write are not exact, okay, the theorem I'm going to write is essentially true. I mean, it's true up to some details which are not important. Details like to change n by n minus 1 or something like this, okay, but some of the identifications are not true. Actually, are not true. But anyway, so in this case, we have to consider a much more difficult space, because in the correlation case, in the bipartite correlation case, we describe the classical correlation matrices just by L infinity tensor L infinity. Right now, we have to consider L infinity of L1 be L infinity of L1, okay? And to work with this space is much more difficult than the other. In particular, we are mixing the classical injective space with the classical projective space, and this, I mean, this involves some problems, okay? But anyway, we have to describe the quantum behavior. So now we write the probabilities in the following way, where, again, we will have to use a density operator acting on a tensor product of two Hilbert spaces to describe a bipartite case, and each of the Alice measurements, that is, for each x, the measurements x will be described by the sequence of positive operators such that the sum is equal to the identity, okay, and the same for both, okay. I consider this is a standard in quantum mechanics, and I suppose all of you know this much better than me, okay. So then the connections now are the following one, okay. P is a quantum behavior if and only if, with the same remark on the if and only if, the associating tensor U belongs to the closed unit ball of this space with now again, we have to consider the projective tensor norm in the sense of operator space. Okay, so in the B-party case, we have to go again to operator spaces to describe, even in the B-party case, the quantum, in this case, the quantum behavior. Okay, well, again, I have not explained what the projective tensor norm in the operator space is, so we can avoid this, okay, just by duality, and we can state we identify a general Bell inequality with a bilinear form on this space, okay, of norm smaller or equal 1, and the largest violation of B is given by its completely bounding norm. Okay, it's exactly the same what I'm saying. Okay, and the theorem we can state in this case is the following one. Given natural number n, consider the Alice and Bob experiment, that is the first experiment I have explained, okay, with k of n measurements in each part, when k of n is of order n power n, and n outputs for each measurement. That is, we have Alice and Bob measuring, okay, and Alice measure, with, I mean, can carry out some different measurements, in this case, k of n different measurements, and each of these measurements has n possible outputs, okay? Then there exists a Bell inequality T in this space, of course, such that the largest violation of T is larger or equal square root of n. Okay? And furthermore, the dimension of the Hilbert space of our system is n. This is because I'm not writing, I mean, this theorem does not appear the dimension of the Hilbert space, but it's just the row we have to give there to construct the quantum behavior. Okay? So, again, we can find unbounded violations. And this theorem says that actually we can even get these unbounded violations with only two people measuring if we allow to use a large number of outputs and, of course, a large number of measurements as before. Okay, so if we consider a large number of outputs, we can get this this violation. Okay? Well, I'm going to finish. I'm going to finish with a couple of remarks. Okay? First of all, the proof of this last theorem is based on the theory of non-commutative LP embedding, which is being developed nowadays by Marius Hume, Gilles Pichet, Javier Pathet, and it's based on embedding, which is much more constructive than in the case of correlation matrices. Okay, so in this case we can give, the Bell inequality we have to construct, it can be constructed. Okay, so. This is what I mean. And another remark, it was already known that in the general case, we could get unbounded violations. It was already known that if Alice and Bob measuring and we allowed a large number of outputs, there exist unbounded violations, okay? But the best result, and the only one that I know of this, it was a violation of this order with n outputs, okay? And we are getting a square root of n with n outputs, okay? I have to point out that regarding the problem of studying largest violations of Bell inequality, our theorem highly improved this result, but this author were not interested just in the largest violations of Bell inequality, okay? They were work on the quantum games problem, on the quantum games problem theory, and they needed to use some kind of Bell inequality with some special properties, okay? And actually the Bell inequality we construct to get these violations does not give these properties, okay? So we don't improve the result in the game theory framework, okay? And it is very, very, very interesting that the proof they did is based on a very, very technical construction of Gott and Wiesnoy in the theory of complexity problem and the unique game conjecture problem. So it would be really interesting to clarify the connections between these problems and the operator spaces theory. So I think that's all. Thank you very much.